Hi, I'm Ozzy. Welcome to the Tales of an African Princess in America podcast. I believe that stories are powerful, and by sharing, we can grow together. That's why I created the Tales of an African Princess in America podcast, to share the unique stories and experiences of African immigrants abroad. Each week, you'll hear topics pertaining to education, healthcare, and career choices, or just pure banter. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Hi guys, welcome to today's episode. Today I have a really interesting guest in the house. I wouldn't really refer to her as a guest because I feel like I've spoken to you so many times that I feel like calling you a guest is almost disrespectful.
But it's okay.
One of the things, you know, I was looking through your website and I'm like, I have to introduce you right because I want our guests to really get a good idea of who you are. You identify with three countries and I'm going to give you a chance to tell us a little bit more about these three countries. I know that you identify yourself with two P's, your prophet, your and your podcaster as well. We do have some things in common. You're a Nigerian, you're into medical research as I am, and we're both podcasters. And so I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. Well, welcome.
Thank you, Ozzy. Or should I say Dr. Ozzy?
No, that's okay. You can call me Ozzy. You know, where I work, a lot of people have the similar degrees, and so we don't call each other by our titles. And so it's a little weird when I come out and I'm talking to someone who is not in my field and they're calling me doctor, and I'm just like, it's a little
Yeah.
So I'm gonna read a little bit from your website, because I went to your website actually.
Oh jeez. Why?
I like to read about what people say about
I apologize as well. I was just kidding. Sure, go ahead.
Good. It's really good. So you say, I moved to the US 7 years ago with 2 checked-in luggage and a Ghana must go back. That had me laughing. Like,
For real though. And I have a story about that, but go ahead.
Yeah. And you say that the bag was filled with some of your most prized possessions.
Books, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Tell me about that.
My babies.
So what books did you bring from Nigeria to the US? Like...
So I have a pharmacy degree, so my pharmacy books, my dictionary, my formularies, the BNF, the British National Formulary. I had a comprehensive pharmacy review because I don't want to, lose touch of my clinical pharmacy knowledge. Mm-hmm. And some novels that I really cherished.
Okay.
And then one on serial killers that, had like a compendium of serial killers. Horrible book, but I liked that book. I'd had it since, I was in high school. Oh. Yeah, so yeah. Those were all my books that I didn't bring a lot of food stuff. I didn't bring a lot of, clothes. It was just books.
And I find that interesting because a lot of times when people move from Nigeria to the US, even to visit, they fill their bags with like food stuff that they're not going to find here in a long time. But you were moving to the US and I'm sure you probably didn't know when you were ever going to go back to Nigeria. And things that you brought were actually books. I think that really speaks to the kind of person that you are. But tell me a little bit more. Like, I know you as Mo, but I know that that's not your full name, right?
With my full government name, yeah, true.
Right. So tell us a little bit about you. Like, I know you're from Nigeria, but what would you like our listeners to know about you tonight?
First of all, thank you so much for bringing me on the show. I'm really honored to, be here. Thank you for all, you've been very helpful. Mm-hmm. And I cannot wait to, at least, be featured in your show. So my name is Motolani Eniola Ogunsanya. That's my full name. It's a Yoruba name. I was born and bred in Nigeria. Lived in Lagos and then went to Oyo for high school, Federal Government Girls College Oyo. After school, I got into UNILAG through diploma to study pharmacy and so got my pharmacy degree from there and finished in 2008 and then was working with Chevron in their medical center.
Okay.
And that was where I really got a hand of a collaborative practice, pharmacists, doctors, lab scientists, everybody, just nurses being, all hands on deck,
right,
which was more what you saw like during your ward rounds at Luther, one of those public spaces. So that kind of gave me like a glimpse of how patient care could be, quite transformative and synergistic. And I worked there for a while and I realized that I need to leave. I get bored easily, one, and I felt like I had reached a peak, but then I didn't think I was growing.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work in Ibadan at the PEPFAR clinic. That's like the HIV AIDS clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that I found my mission in life, which, I was fresh out of school, arrogant, really bright, but I wasn't really connected with the patients very well,
Mm-hmm.
And compared to the patients I was seeing in Chevron, they were very privileged. These patients were at the HIV clinic. Some of them would have to like get on the public bus like at 5 o'clock in the morning to make their 8 o'clock appointment because it was a free clinic. And just seeing all of those social determinants of health, play was a shock for me because, living a sheltered life and from Chevron to, this, you know, rural area as it were. Right. And in talking to my patients, I realized that I wasn't quite effective as far as the pharmacist. Like, I knew all the drugs did to the body. Mm-hmm. I knew what the body did, what the body did to the drugs, but the main component, which was the end user, the patient behavior, why they wouldn't be very adherent to the medications. Mm-hmm. And unlike, you know, Chevron, where you had all kinds of patients with HIV, it was just HIV and, you know, opportunistic infections like tuberculosis and whatever viral infections they had. And if your adherence were to drop to like below 90%, your viral load would go up and your cells, your white blood cells, the CD4, which was the indicator, then would go down. So you could tell the patient was lying, like, oh, I take my medication. Uh-uh, God, your blood says no. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And when you lose patience, and it started hitting at me that I needed to really go back to school to really learn. And while I was in pharmacy school, I had a professor or lecturer tell me, you need to go get a PhD. And I scorned at her, like, you know how you think about PhD? You see all of those PhD students, you know, on the first floor, looking right. Like they didn't have any life. I'm not going to enter the app. But, you know, I found a way and applied to schools. I was supposed to go to the UK, but then my friend told her, she said, if with the kind of grades you have, if I were you, I would aim higher and go to the US. Oh, wow. I didn't want to write GRE because I thought it was just stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, going to study math and English and whatnot, whatever, quantitative or qualitative reasoning, whatever it was, or verbal. But I did it, and like sometimes I'll wake up with panic attacks in Lagos in my bedroom then, because I was like, what am I doing in this country? Mm-hmm. But I got into University of Texas at Austin and started my PhD there in health economics and outcomes research.
I know you said that, you know, you had the choice of going to the UK or the US, right?
Yeah.
And for a lot of Nigerians, these are the two countries that we actually think about. Because when I speak to people who have moved to the US for school or who have even thought about going to other countries who are currently living in Nigeria, they talk about these two countries. And why do you think Nigerians are fixated on the US and UK?
I think there are many factors for it, but off the top of my head, I think one is like the common countries. Like, you know, we learn to like, we know someone that has done it, that it has worked for. Because we learn to live vicariously through people, you know.
Right.
Your neighbor has this new Ghana must go bag, you want to get the same thing, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And UK and US are just those two countries.
Right.
And the danger of that is that we tend to lose out on other opportunities. Like, I have friends now in Germany, you know, with, you know, full ride and doing good work there. Mm-hmm. Good work there. Even some people in China and Korea. We just don't, I think the lack of information will make people flock to those countries. And it paid off for me, though, you know. And I wouldn't be that kind of, you know, copying somebody, because I did actually copy someone, one of my seniors. She gave me all the tips, you know, how to write your statement of work, how to, you know, study very well, how to ask for financial aid. So
and I know you're super bright. I know that, like, that is something I caught on pretty quickly when I started talking to you.
Well, thank you.
So I know GRE was like really easy for you. Did you have to study a lot to write that graduate?
Are you kidding me? Yes. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I love math, you know. Fun fact, I almost veered into chemical engineering. As a matter of fact, the first time I wrote JAMB was when I was in secondary school.
Okay.
And the second time I wrote JAMB was when everybody was writing it. And I just changed my course to chemical engineering. But with GRE is kind of different, because remember, I was out of school for a while. I was working already.
Mm-hmm.
And having to like fit studying, you know, and I don't really do well by myself studying. I mean, as far as for exam purposes, I'm that kind of person that will lead tutorials and, you know, bring people together. I teach, I learn more.
Okay.
So having to study by myself, and I didn't have that discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was quite difficult, though, in the sense of just trying to create time. But when those panic attacks started happening,
right,
it was for, because I just thought to myself, this is just GRE. Like, I'm going to face a lot more when I get to grad school. Like, this is just like a means to an end. It's not even the main thing. And that's why I used to encourage my people that I mentor now, like, you think GRE is the end of the world? No.
Mm-hmm.
Just find it's difficult, like, do your best and score as high as you can. But there's going to be a lot more, because the discipline you apply to studying for those exams is going to really help you to ace more stuff when you get to school eventually.
Right. A lot of times I tell people that these standardized tests are not like an indication of how bright you are, really. It's just about how much can you study in a short time, you know? And a lot of people get discouraged when they don't do well the first time, and they're like, I'm not qualified to go to grad school. And you'd be surprised how many people took those exams and they're doing really phenomenally well right now. So if you're out there just trying to pass or ace a standardized test, just know that it's just for the time being. If you don't do well the first time, go ahead and take it again. Prepare and take it
exactly.
Again.
And some schools do know this, and that's why they don't put a lot of emphasis on those scores.
Mm-hmm.
They have like a lower threshold for it. As long as you have like a high score, like your GPA was, you know, quite decent.
Right.
And you can write a statement of purpose. I think there was one school that I heard about that if you scored lower than their cutoff point for GRE, they'll ask you to write a reason for it.
Oh, wow.
Because there's some other factors, you know, exam tension, your environment where you were studying and things like that. Mm-hmm. They had a death in the family. Just, you know, and English, the GRE words, like, nobody uses those words. If you were to talk to your friends in GRE words, they'll stop talking to you because nobody uses those words anymore, you know. So, yeah. I still use them once in a while, though, because I miss those words.
So did you stop working to study for the test, or you just did both at the same time?
No, I was doing both at the same time, yeah. Wow. And I had to take the GRE and then the TOEFL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how long did you study for the GRE?
I want to say like 2-3 months.
Okay.
And TOEFL, I did it in a week or so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. TOEFL is, I find TOEFL like easier. I found it a little easier because it's just English, you know. But yeah. GRE was a little challenging, so I had to put in a little more effort. So that's why I'm wondering how long it took you. And you know, how easy was it to get a visa? Like, that's something that a lot of people are scared. Was this your first time?
No. I was that person that was like, I don't care for this country. I don't care why people just go there and they feel like it's heaven.
Mm.
I was anti-US. Like, I was just not desperate for the US, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to travel the world. I just knew that growing up. But I knew it wasn't going to be to the point of having to sell my soul or do things, you know, scrupulous.
Right.
So I had never applied for any kind of visa. You know, I've been to Ghana. I've been to Syria. I'd been to Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Togo. You know, neighboring countries in West Africa before I applied for the US visa. Because
mm-hmm.
I used to do medical missions and, you know, I'd gone on a trip one time to mm-hmm. Ghana. So I just made sure that, number one, the school I was applying to was, you know, there are so many schools here that they call them diploma mills. They're not well accredited and accredited. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful. They might just, you know, get your money and then, you know, you go to the consular office, they tell you that's in good school and they deny your visa. So when I was applying for schools, it had to be the top 10 because I wasn't going to just go to any school. Like, that was very important for me because I wanted to learn from the best. And I still think, you know, the US is the best when it comes to like advancement in, you know, my field and, you know, some of the things I hope to become.
Right.
And so I made sure I did everything right, you know, did my GRE, had good scores. I got a letter from my school, my admission letter, of course, my I-20 service and all that. And every year you apply, I mean, every year you're planning to travel to study, there's always something.
Right.
Then it was like, they're not giving people visa, they're denying people. This time around it's Trump or something. There's always something, FYI, let me tell you. But if it's meant to be, it's going to be. That's what I want to say. Don't let people project their frustration, their seed of, you know, disbelief into you.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why I'm very careful not to transform my frustration to people and make it their reality. So on the day of the interview, you know, I went there and, you know, even the whole, you know, fairity, that's even a word. You know, it was just too, I just didn't like the way some people were being treated during the interview. There was a person that was just crying, like, you know, begging, and they were like, you know, you have really? To leave. We've been... Yeah.
Wow.
And so I went with my husband, by the way, because he was supposed to call us my spouse. But we just got married, actually. Oh. We got married in June, and then we went for the interview in August, and I was supposed to resume school in August. Oh, well, I had a little bit of a snafu with my I-20 or something, so...
Mm-hmm.
By the time my school replied and did all of that, fixing and everything. Remember, this was before internet, like accessible internet. You had to go to a cyber cafe. You had to go around with a modem. So, and the time difference, you know, you send an email in the morning, you wait for the next day for them to reply you. Anyways, I didn't get my I-20 in time. And by the time I went, I had to resume school like a week before I went for my interview.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the... emergency, whatever. Anyways, went to Abuja because, you know, that was the nearest date we could get. And then we got there. My husband before then, he had been there twice because he had a brother here and was planning to come visit, but they, you know, denied him.
Okay.
So he was a little bit fretish, and, you know, and I had this cough all of a sudden. I started coughing and he was like, stop coughing. I'm like, why would I be coughing? Like, am I supposed to breathe here? Because he was like, you know, they're watching us on the camera. And he's the, you know,
oh, that is so funny.
I'm more of the rebel. I'm the rule breaker in the house. He's more of the, you know, stick it to the road. But I just had this, I don't care. Like, I'm just going to tell them what I'm going to do there. If they don't want to give me, it wasn't going to, you know, basically it wasn't going to be a do or die affair for me.
Right.
So, you know how you sit down. You sit down and there are like three consular officers. And the next person goes to the available spot.
Yeah.
And that guy that had been denying everybody, you know, all day long. The moment you just went to his cubicle was like, he gives you that slip. I think it was pink or green, whatever the color of denial was.
Right.
And so everybody was trying to avoid him.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do the math. You knew that, oh, the next person was supposed to go to this guy. And this guy got up and then he went to use the restroom because he wanted to avoid this bad consular officer. Let me just call him bad. Luckily for him, by the time he spent quite a deal of time in the restroom, by the time he came back, it was just for him to be dead outside next, because the guy took a while with the other person and he didn't want to get up. They were like, next, he didn't want to get up. But of course, they denied him, whatever the reason was. And then we ended up going to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already, you know, my friend, my senior friend, colleague that I told you about,
yeah,
her name is Fumi. She was on our, you know, I just, you know, use her playbook. Just like, you know, look them in the eye. You know how in Nigeria, you know, we're supposed to look at our other ones in the eye.
Yeah.
Look them in the eye. Yeah. Don't provide any extra information that they didn't ask you for.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever question they ask you, answer it directly. Don't provide any extra nothing. You know how Nigerian now, we just want to tell dog and the cat and the muscle. Yeah. To them, they think you're trying to, you know, overcompensate or even lie.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, in Chevron, I had, like, you know, buses are a foreign train. So that whole thing of avoiding eye contact, I had already, you know, been cured of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked him in the eye. I was like, so what are you going to do? I'm like, you know, going to get my PhD, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that was it. Then he focused his attention on my husband. I see you're a doctor. What are you planning to do while your wife is going to be in school?
Okay.
And he said, we didn't even talk about this. Because, and he goes, well, I'm going to support her, you know, and I plan to write a book, a romance novel.
Wait. This was, like, impromptu. Like, did he plan to say that?
It was, he did, no. We didn't even talk about this, you know? Novel. I know. So, next time you see him, just ask him about his novel. How is his novel going? Of course, he didn't write any novel.
Oh, my God. That is so funny. That's the funniest thing I've heard today.
I know. I mean, well, he's been denied twice before then. So, you know,
yeah.
But it was as if he was the primary applicant and I was invisible. But anyways,
wow.
They were like, okay, well, we should, and then they asked him, do you have a sibling there? Now, him and his brother, like, you know, he hadn't seen his brother for years because his brother came here to study and then stayed back and, you know, got married and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, yeah, I have a sibling. And they were like, what does he do? And he really didn't remember because, you know, he didn't remember what his brother did. I was like, I don't really remember what he does, but I know he lives, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they could sense that genuinity, that, okay, he's not going to, genuineness in him, that he's not going to get stuck here. And then that's how we got the visa.
Wow.
And that was it. Yeah. So, you know, tips. Stick to the story. Don't give extra information. Be very bold. Arrange your document. Don't let your papers, like, fly everywhere.
Mm.
There was a lady that forgot her I-20 or something like that. It's too, like, of all things to forget, you know. So that's just a visa story.
You know what? One of the things that really I find really, really important in what you just said, of course, everything you said is important, but one thing that's, you know, stood out to me is this issue of eye contact. Like, that's something that I've had that conversation with a lot of people. They say people from Nigeria don't make eye contact. And it's true. Like, it's not something we're encouraged to do. Like, sometimes, you know, when you're growing up and your mom is talking to you and maybe you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You're looking at her eyes and she's like, oh, you're looking at me, right? You're looking
at me. You want to fight me. You want to fight me. But yeah, come now.
But I still find it a little weird when people look at you.
And I should also say that it's not just Nigerians, though. I mean, I speak Korean. I know a little bit about the Korean culture. It's also in the Asian culture.
Yeah.
I think Korean, I know Japanese people do that. And some Chinese people do that. It's just, you know, it's rude to stare at your people that are older than you when they're talking to you. Don't look at them. You look away.
Hmm. And so you got a little bit about your education in Nigeria. So you were a pharmacist, right?
I was a pharmacist. Nigeria prepared me adequately for that. You know, English pharmacy was, you know, was quite a good thing.
So how will you compare the American educational system to the Nigerian? Like, do you think that, I know a lot of people say, yeah, in Nigeria, we have a long way to go in terms of technology.
Yeah.
When I went to school, we just started using PowerPoint presentations. And, you know, lecturers were incorporating that into their classes. But before that, you know, people were still writing on the board, you know, taking away the technology part because we're nowhere kind of backwards with technology.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Nigerian educational system is doing well to prepare people for future, like their future careers?
I think the problem really is that the teachers aren't, like, adequately trained. But even in all of those defects, there are some things that I think Nigeria does a lot better than the US. I think it's just that tenacity at education. Number one, there's that emphasis on education being that main key thing to, like, bring you out of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in the family structure, like, you know, parents, moms, dads, you know, really, you know, sacrificing a lot to make sure that their kids go to school.
Mm-hmm.
That's really big. And with the broken down system we have a lot of teachers that are quite passionate, but it's like, you know, a passionate soldier without the right tools, you know, is going to just get killed.
Right.
And I think for me, the way Nigeria really prepared me was just to be very hardworking at what I did, because we're good with the theory part of things, like, you know,
right,
we can. But to apply them, our labs, for example, are not equipped.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really, our classrooms are not, you know, quite, you know, equipped with so many of these things that we need.
Yeah.
But some professors or lecturers, as they're called in Nigeria, you could see that passion in them. Why I really fought Nigerian teachers is that fear-based system of teaching people.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't, like, you know, because I used to read widely a lot, and sometimes I would want to ask questions that might seem like I was trying to undermine the authority of my professor, which I wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was probably going to be like another opinion I wanted to assert. I would never dare do that. To feel like you were challenging them. So I remember the first, when you get to grad school, you know, there's emphasis on discussion. That's like 30% of your scores, and then your term paper. So discussion in class and how you, like, you know, put out your thoughts and all that.
Yeah.
And as a Nigerian, you know, go getter, almost always having A, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought weekly in the class, I realized I haven't opened my mouth in this class. So, and it was, you know, healthcare policy in the US or something. I was so amazed at how my American counterparts, when they would talk, like, they came from, it wasn't just, you know, everybody would read the article. Mm-hmm. But they were drawing parallels from other things that I didn't have anything. Like, I was searching myself, like, what do I compare this? I wasn't reading widely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any historical facts or any current news to, like, you know, draw parallels to what they were talking about. And that really made me sad because I knew I was smart, but I was feeling stupid in class.
Right.
So before the next class, I knew what the topic was going to be. I started watching some late night shows that, you know, they talk about politics and healthcare here. So
yeah,
it was kind of easier for me. And I felt like equipped. So I went to class and I remember just opening my mouth. And the thing I said was a little bit, it was contrary to what the professor said.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was a good point I was raising because he was talking about the exceptionalism of the healthcare system. So I rebutted that fact. But after I said that and to the end of the class, I just thought to myself, they're coming to get me and deport me. I have challenged my professor. This is the end. Let me just call my mother. Because I thought I had done something really bad. Because you were never taught to, like, talk, not like talk back, but to air your opinion, like, not, however contrary, like, you know, have a discourse. It could be opposing and all that, but not being oppositional.
Yes.
I go to him. I was like, Dr. Lawson, I'm so sorry. I think I spoke too much and I didn't mean to, like, you know, be rude. And it was like, you know, I've been waiting for you to talk because I read your reflection paper. I know you're really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that one day you could open your mouth and say something else. I appreciate your contribution. And I think you should write a paper about it. Would you like to come have, you know, coffee together and talk? Come to my office and talk about it. And by the way, call me by my first name, Ken. I say, hey, Ken. And that was it. And, you know, for the first time in my life, someone told me that my voice mattered in the classroom, and I didn't have to, like, regurgitate whatever they learned from somebody to me, and I had to, like, regurgitate that. I took what they gave to me,
mm-hmm.
but I created my voice out of it. That is why I fought the Nigerian educational system.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like some of the notes we used in class, like, you borrowed it from the set before you, and it was the same thing, verbatim, taught every now and then. It didn't evolve.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't updated. I don't know if it's changed now, but that was how it was for us. And that doesn't make you think globally. And I didn't like that part.
Okay. Yeah. What I personally notice is the difference between the way you're trained in Nigeria and here, which you said the fear-based system of learning. It's like training you by putting you down. So for instance, like, you have a whole classroom of students, right? And there's maybe two people that do really well in class. And the lecturer is constantly telling the other people how unserious they are, basically. You know, if you're serious enough, you do well. And I feel like that's a method of putting people down, trying to guilt them into doing better. But what it actually does, it alienates them from those who are actually doing better. Because to do well, you have to collaborate with those who are doing better, see how they're studying, try to figure out why it is that they're doing better than you, you know, learn from them. But by saying that those people are, you know, unserious, they don't take their studies, you know, seriously, they don't study, it might just be the method of teaching or, you know, the way information is passed down. Another thing that I find that I criticize is the system of just cramming, basically. So what I give, don't give me extra. Don't give me, like you were saying, don't ask me questions that are not in the syllabus, you know? And so those are the kind of things that when I came to the US as well, I had to wrap my mind around, like, okay, now it's okay to speak in class. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay, your contributions are okay, even if you're wrong, you know? Because back then in Nigeria, like, if you're wrong, there's this thing, they look at you like, oh my goodness, you said that, you know?
I know, right?
Yeah. That comes with another put let down or put down, you know, like, you're not studying enough. How could you say that, you know? But here, everyone is, it's not a right or wrong thing. It's your opinion. And if you're, you know,
it's your opinion.
Bring things
And as a student, the professors know you're basically paying the salary. So They want to give you the best, you know, of your, almost like a service. And sometimes the flip side is that the students know their rights so much. So some, I've heard my friends that teach in schools now tell me that after I'm the one paying for your tuition, I'm the one paying your salary, and they get so ornery about it. But yeah, they feel like, I mean, I think even the cramming, I would say it's been helpful to me. But I think because my nature as a person, I'm an information forager, and I've always been curious as a kid. Like, I would read dictionaries, I read encyclopedias. I wanted to just know the first principles, like, why is this that? But a lot of times, professors just tell you, accept it. That's how it is. But why?
Yes.
You know, and if you keep asking the why questions, you get into trouble, like you're seen oppositional. So I think my just being smart really helped me scale in school. But I felt a lot of things, I didn't feel fulfilled as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the system. You know, I've had some very good teachers that without their input in my life, I probably wouldn't be here today. They took the time to like build me up. And so I'm not going to like, you know, take that from them.
Yes.
Because you really do have some good teachers in Nigeria. It's just the system sucks.
Outside just in the classroom, like that challenge of contributing in class or, you know, speaking up in class, what were some of the things, the three things that you find were new to you or like challenges for you when you first moved to the US?
I think it was just that, you know, having to play with every, like, you know, be together but separate.
Okay.
So the way we were in Nigeria was, everybody just hoarded the knowledge themselves. Like, you had these, you know, PQs or areas where you don't share those knowledge. So having to have that openness and, you know, sharing your knowledge, because it has to evolve and it doesn't become your own anymore because you put it in the communal pool. So I had to break, you know, that silly habit that I, you know, had gotten used to. That's one.
Hoarding knowledge.
That's a hoarding knowledge. And then two was probably just adjusting to the system. Now, I grew up, you know, on a very healthy, staple diet of American movies and media. You know, I used to watch the movies a lot. I used to watch a lot of series, Friends, you know, and all of that. But having to live here, I think there's a part of me that I just felt disconnected from my external environment. And maybe it was a longing for home, or a longing to just, you know, be accepted. Because, you know, I'm even here, I moved here in my 20s.
Right.
And it was quite difficult, though. And I'm quite as extrovertish as I come. And I think I make friends easily, but it was still very difficult because you find that as a whole, and this is just a general statement, by the way, Americans can be friendly, but they necessarily don't want to be friends with you. So I meet you for the first time, and I'm quite good at names. You tell me your name, you tell me what you do. I register that. And next time I see you, I want to greet you nicely. And you say hi the next, and they look at you like, ooh, you know, I don't remember you. So that, you know, I think most of the time is a cultural thing because they are so individualistic. And, you know, they'll be like, we should totally have coffee sometimes. And I'm thinking in my head, we should totally have lunch sometimes. And I'm thinking in my head, I'm going to make jollof rice and plantains and they can come over. But it never happens, you know.
I think it's just it's just something to say, I guess.
It is. And I don't think they're not being genuine about it. I think it's just, you know, like, how's the weather? Like, what's the color of the sky? That kind of, you know, empty talks. But I took them seriously. But I found that, you know, I still kept, you know, persisting, and I found my friends, I found my community. And a lot of people that I found them were also international, lost people like me that wanted that sense of community, or even Americans already used to international people. And whether it's mutually loving company or we just, you know, trying to find community together, that really helped. So that was the second one. And I think the third one was just being grad school as a whole, you know. It's quite difficult to, I mean, I've been through, marriage is hard, grad school is harder, I think. And I think just having to keep to task, you know, all of my courses, keep doing good work and just adjusting to the changing system. Whereas in school where you could, you know, read a particular part and they would test you on it, grad school was papers and term papers and projects and, you know, qualifiers. And so that was difficult, though, just navigating that system and building up until, you know, a point where I realized, okay, I'm ready to graduate and start my dissertation. And then, okay, what next now? What am I going to do? I have to get a job and things like that. But, you know, it's just life and it's difficult and things will get easy. And then you move on and you grow up and you advance in life. I think that's just all part of it.
Yeah, and you spoke a little bit about your family. Now, you said you were married before you moved to the U.S. And do you think that actually made life a little easier for you being married? Or because coming to the U.S. single versus coming as a married woman, do you feel like your struggles were shared. You now had your partner to share in the struggles of settling in a new community. Do you think that that helped being married, or do you feel like that came with its own challenges that were even worse than the single person would have experienced?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I have a very supportive husband, and even though he came here as a spouse, so what that means for those that don't know is that he had to stay at home for a while because we weren't going to break the laws and have him go, you know, doing some under the table work jobs and all that.
Right.
And so I was advancing in my career. Like, you know, he would come to my presentations, he would listen in, he would give me feedback, he would, you know, edit my stuff. But I knew, and he's a trained medical doctor. He wasn't able to get a job for a while because he had to take the boards and all of that. So at the point I was getting really moody about it, like, you know, and he's someone that he would never, I mean, he's that wonderful of a person. I don't think I could have done what he did. He never got jealous. He never, like, you know, said, you brought me here to suffer. Because we kind of knew what the, you know, challenge was going to be. But having the knowledge of what the situation could necessarily be and being in it, they're two different things. So while, you know, I had that support from him, I felt really depressed at times when I come home. And I think I wrote about that on my blog. I talked about it in the blue chair. And he would just be home, just studying. And for 3 years, he was home. Mm. And there was a time I just told him, hey, we need to do something different. How about just go do your master's? And why are you trying to get into your system to, like, practice as a doctor? And there's so many exams you have to take. And then you have to, like, apply for job interviews. Hopefully, you match into a program. And because we didn't have a green card then, it was just visas. A lot of places weren't international medical graduate friendly or IMG friendly. Mm-hmm. So he went to get his master's in public health, and he started having his own life, his social life, his academic life, and that really made me a lot happier. But yeah, the social support was there, but it was difficult because, remember, your stipend was split two ways. You had to take care of somebody else as well.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of challenges with that, but we managed it through. I look back on those days, and, you know, even though it seemed tough and all that, we made do with what we had. Yeah, so...
Mm-hmm. So you just hit another really important issue, and that's immigration. Oh, yeah. Like, I could write a whole book about immigration. I'm really happy that your husband, you know, of course, it's never going to be easy when you move to a new place. No. But having that support is critical. Like, if you don't have a support, seek help. Like, look for people, build your own community, because you're going to need it. You're going to need people to be there for you, being so far away from home. Right, and sure. I know your parents were in Nigeria at the time. Was there, like, pressure to also support your family? You know, people move from Nigeria, but they also have, like, our culture is one that, you know, we're always thinking about our extended family, our parents.
Yeah.
Do you feel that pressure to quickly graduate, to get a job, and, you know, support your family?
Not really, though. So our parents were quite supportive. In fact, there was a time when the dollar was still not as powerful as it is right now, relative to the Nigerian currency, Naira. Mm-hmm. So then I think the exchange was 100 and something. We used to get some money from our parents, as a matter of fact. You know, they'll send money to us, you know, just to help. Those time we were applying for the national interest waiver. And our parents pulled in money to send, you know, to us. And so we didn't have any pressure to be, you know, done with work. And, you know, even though I'm the first child and he's the last one of, you know, seven kids. Mm-hmm. And we didn't feel that pressure from them. In fact, they were very supportive. But when, you know, the Naira crashed and it was like 300 or something, we had to, like, tell them, it's okay, don't send money anymore. There's no need. Yeah. It doesn't even make sense, you know. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, when we're working now, we were paying back. Not like paying back, but we're glad to at least be able to help our parents, you know.
Yeah. But there are people who are obligated. Like, mm-mm. As soon as they're moving to a new country, that obligation is there, whether said or unsaid, to help. Or to do something, send money home. And that puts an incredible amount of pressure on people where they are doing things that they would never have thought they could ever do just because they have to take care of their siblings back home, pay rent for their family back home, or do things like that. And so I'm happy that you at least had that support from your parents. That's a big deal. Yeah, post-graduation, how easy was it to get a job?
So in my program, well, in the kind of degree you get, you can either go towards the academic route or work with big pharma or consulting. And your dissertation actually positions you for a job because you, based on the methodology you use or your implications for the healthcare and research, basically determines where you're going to end up. Now, because I was very confused as a human being, I had gone on an internship with a biotech company in Boston, and I really loved it. And so I was kind of confused because I like teaching, I like academia, I like, you know, the independence to explore research questions, but I also liked, you know, the specificity of working with a tech company or even a pharma company. So when I picked my dissertation topic, I spun it in such a way that if I went for an academic interview, I could make it sound like the very next in best thing since sliced bread, and vice versa when I went for my, you know, pharma job. So I actually got 2 offers at the end of the day, and that was me just starting out. Like I had other ones that were potentially offers on the table. Mm-hmm. And one was with a consulting firm and another one was with academia. And I really loved them. You know, I was so confused. I reached out to all of my mentors, mm-hmm. and their grand mentors and their great grand mentors. And everyone had like an opinion, like, you know, mm-hmm. you should go to that pharma place. You should go to academia. And I settled with the consulting firm, and I didn't want to email them. Like, I was going to accept the offer. Mm-hmm. But am I going to bed that night just feeling uneasy with myself? And there's a way God speaks to me. I'm Christian, by the way, for those listening. That's where God speaks to me. I don't get that peace of mind when I finally make a decision. Okay. And that was it with the consulting firm. I felt like I was settling for less. Mm-hmm. And less in a sense, it didn't make sense because the academia, the pay wasn't, you know, I mean, it was okay, but consulting, you to pay more. So
yeah.
I mean, it didn't make sense that I felt like I was settling for less. But anyway, so after that whole unease in my body and in myself, I emailed them back and turned down the offer. And I accepted academia. And I think I like where I am right now. I like the freedom it gives me. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say to those that are probably at the cusp of where I was many years ago is rely on people that know you very well.
Okay.
You know, my mentors, my advisors, even though they all had different things to say about me, one thing someone said to me was like, wherever you end up going, you'll be fine. Because it's you, you're bringing yourself with you. Mm-hmm. If you start out in this spot, you don't like it, guess what? You can move on and change it to something else.
Yes.
You know, I just thought it was going to be the end of the world if I chose one versus the other.
I think it's also our probably upbringing. We think that once we've chosen a path, because I studied microbiology in my undergrad. And when I was moving to the US, people told me, continue with microbiology, as if that was my curse or my blessing. You know, if you feel like this is not your calling, switch. It's okay to try new things and decide that, oh, this is not for me, you know? But I guess when we choose in a career, when we get into even our first jobs, you know, we're thinking this is where I'll retire from. And so this decision is so huge. I have to, you know, get it right. And we put ourselves under undue stress. But what you said is right, exactly, that if you try something and you don't like it, it doesn't work out. Guess what? You can always switch to the next thing. You know? That's really good. But yeah.
That's it. And then they were like, you know, also remember that you're bringing something to the company. You know, well, whatever you're going to end up, your individuality, your unique skills. Mm-hmm. We don't think of that in a job interview. We think of it like we're at the mercy of the interviewer.
Oh, yeah.
What if I don't like you? What if I don't like your company as well? Like, put some validation in your pocket, like who you are as a person. Because all the trainings you received, the research you've done, the publications you've done, the unique skill sets you have,
yeah,
that comes with the package. So, you know, give something to yourself as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I currently work as an assistant professor of pharmacy here in Oklahoma. And I do research in cancer and rare diseases like Aussie does.
Yeah. I think it's lupus, right?
Yes, lupus. Cutaneous lupus. Yeah.
Yeah. Now that we know a little bit about you, we know that you moved to America, you know, went to grad school here, graduated. Of course, you moved with your husband. So dating was out of the question. I was going to ask you a little bit about it. out of the question. You graduated, you got a job as an assistant professor. Can you tell me a little bit about your connection with, because you've mentioned 3 countries. I know you have love for 3 countries. You love Nigeria because you were born there. But there's Korea and there's the United States. Can you tell me a little bit about your connection with these 3 countries, particularly Korea?
Well, Nigeria will always, you know, have that special place in my heart because, you know, I grew up there and it built me up to be who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about baking, you know, the dough, kneading the dough and prepping it for whatever you're going to add on it, that was Nigeria.
Okay.
And it was tough growing up. But, you know, everything added up to, you know, this person that is behind the mic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thankful for that. It's not the perfect place right now. We've had a lot of issues economically and all of that. But the people are so wonderful. And I always still say that Nigerians are probably one of the best people on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't deserve that country we have. U.S. Gave me an opportunity. U.S. gave me a voice.
Okay.
Nigeria, some parts of them, some experiences growing up as a female in Nigeria, your voices were suppressed in some spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I know things are changing right now. But U.S. gave me a voice. U.S. gave me that independence to pursue my dreams. And that pursuit of happiness, I think it's very entrenched in the US. But I like that the upbringing I had in Nigeria has really, you know, restrained me. And of course, love of Christ as well. So take, for example, credit card. I don't go out on that because we don't have that in Nigeria. So I remember the day I had to, if I want, I had to ask, do I really need to have a credit card? I don't want it. They're like, no, you have to build trust and you need credit card. It was almost as if I had a dynamite in my house. Like, I kept looking at it, like, this credit. The first time I brought it home, he told me I brought, like, a piranha pet home. So, but that Nigerian upbringing of money that you don't have, you don't spend. It's on your money. So that's helped me. And the U.S. also helped me with, you know, the dreams I thought I could never achieve. I've been able to do that here because the system kind of works.
Yeah.
You know, the system works. I mean, people can say all they can about the U.S. It's not a perfect place. There's no perfect place on earth. I don't believe there is.
Okay.
But coming from Nigeria and all the available resources here, and I think as an international person living here, you're more primed to see opportunities than people that were already born here, because they're used to a life of luxury. If you grew up, you know, in a place that was developing, and you move, you know, up like that upward mobility, you're, you can see things differently. You can pursue opportunities. So my hope is to always remember where I'm coming from and remember the struggles back home, and not get too, you know, comfortable. So in such a way that I start, you know, developing first world problems and not forgetting what really matters, you know, and that's to be, you know, great and ingrained in my community and being, you know, really useful and helpful to those that are back home and those within my environment. Now, Korea was just, I don't know how it happened. I really had no idea because a little fact about me, I could speak French very well, but I don't speak it as fluently as before. But I wasn't really interested in the French culture. I didn't find it, you know, interesting enough to pursue it. But Korea just came, you know, accidentally. I had a Korean roommate when I went for that internship in Boston, and we were colleagues together. So when we take classes together, she would scribble some things on that note. I'll be like, can I borrow your note after class? And the first time I saw the circles and rods, I was like, what are those? She was like, oh, that's my language, Korean. I'm like, eh, looks weird. When I stayed with her in Boston, she would make rice every day. She had this rice cooker that could spoke in Korean. I didn't know what it said. But the rice was sticky and yummy. And she would make bulgogi, which is like barbecued, you know, beef. And she had fried egg. Like, she ate rice every day. I'm like, you guys eat rice every day? How come you're so skinny? Like, I don't need a culture where I can eat rice without having to say Hail Mary 5 times. And apparently, they flipped the pyramid upside down. So Koreans eat a lot of rice, but they balance that with, you know, vegetables and proteins. Whereas in Nigeria, rice was the main thing, you know. Proteins were like, you know, sparse. So, and I started talking more and more, and I realized that when she talked about her mom and I talked about my mom, it was as if we're talking about the same mom.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah, because mothers do the same thing, you know, everywhere, you know, and Asian and African moms, oh my gosh. I think there was like a secret boot camp they all went to like learn how to like push their kids, you know, towards success. And I realized that for the first time that people are similar all over the world. It's just that if we don't get to like sit down and talk to them, we probably wouldn't know these things. And then the trap was she started making me watch Korean drama on Netflix. And that was a trap. And I got into it. But then when I watch TV, most of the time I use it as background noise because I'm walking in the background. But with Korean, you have to like read, you know, the translations. And I was like, you know, it was just, you had to like focus. And I didn't want that. Because my brain moves, like, you know, very quickly. So, and that was 2014. And 2017, I was switching between my F1 to H1 because I didn't go on an OPT. And I had gone to, my husband had started working in New Mexico during his residency. And I had gone to stay with him. And I remember going to bed that night. It was sometime in January. And I got an email from Coursera. I had taken some courses on Coursera before. So I get, like, you know, courses recommended for you, and smack dab on my screen was Learn Korean 101. And I remember rolling my eyes. Who are these losers that learn languages over the internet? Go to your real school and be real with yourself, my friend. But I was like, what the heck? So, and remember, it was 11 o'clock at night, thereabout. I plopped up on my computer and I, you know, watched the first video. And an hour later, I could read the language. I could read Hangul, which is, you know, the Korean language. And I wouldn't know what the words meant, but I could sound them. I could phonetically sound them. And I went to bed feeling like I had never had that feeling in a while. Like a new portal opened to me. I don't know if you've seen Pan's Labyrinth, when she, or maybe discovering Narnia, when they discovered Narnia through the cupboard. It was as if like a new world opened up to me and I could see something else. I felt like I had won a million bucks. I went to bed really happy. And I woke up the next morning thinking I was going to forget it, but I didn't, you know. And I started building on that. And, you know, 6 months was self-taught. And I'm someone that I get obsessed about ideas. And I think I do have an addictive personality. When I like something, I like it. Like, I do it over and over again. Yeah. And so I applied a lot of that to language learning. And 6 months, I was, you know, deep into a basic learner. But because when you're learning language, there's the input and the output part of it. I was good with the input because I was self-taught.
Yeah.
But I wasn't very good with conversing. I had to imagine the words or write them down before I could say them. But communication in real world doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I decided to go to a language school. And yeah, so right now I've been doing that for three years now. I'm like intermediate, mid-intermediate. I'm moving towards advanced. Wow. And with Korean culture, it's helped me. I'm learning the language, opened up a lot of possibilities for me. And learn more about their culture. I actually wrote a piece on Medium comparing Nigeria to Korea and how we too can borrow from them as far as borrow a leaf or two from them as far as economic development. And it's one of my most read Medium articles. It has about 5,000 people that have read it, which, you know, is amazing. Because when I wrote it, I was like, I wasn't sure. Because, you know, I'm not like a historical guru, but I like history, and I like, you know, at least knowing about what has worked for somebody and how we can borrow that. And I think Nigeria and Korea are similar in that regard. If we can, you know, have nationalistic government, a good kind that can really, you know, they're very genuine and they want to really eradicate poverty and improve the lives of people. We haven't really had a president like that. And so that's been the Korean experience for me. I have Korean friends now, a lot of them, and we get together, practice.
Get together with your Korean friends, do you speak the language?
Yes. Oh, in fact, I have one that we bind each other from, she doesn't speak English to me and I don't speak English to her. And so I'm practicing speaking more because, you know, vocabulary was easy for me to learn because I could take that. And yeah, so now I teach Korean now, basic Korean in my language school. Yeah, because remember I learned through teaching. So yeah, I think there's so many similarities between our culture as well. They love food, they party around food. They are also, they have this respect for their older people, which we do have. And there's a love for country they have. Koreans can be quite nationalistic. And so that can be off-putting for a lot of, you know, non-Koreans to understand. But if you understand how far they've come as a country and how the heritage was robbed off by the Japanese, you understand why they need to take pride in their country. Because a lot of them, they couldn't use their Korean names. They couldn't speak their language for a long time. And Nigerians can be that way too. You know how we are, like, with Africans, like Nigeria is like the only country in Africa. So I do see those similarities between Nigerian culture and Korean culture. So that's Korean for me. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So for you, after graduation, you got your PhD, then worked in a university, you switched to H1B after your OPT. Do you use your OPT at all?
I didn't. I didn't even get an OPT. I'm crazy that way. I went from an F1 straight to a H1B in my school because it's a university, a public university. Mm-hmm. We had premium, you know, processing. So under like a month, I had my H1B. Yeah.
Wow. And then from there, they applied for your green card?
I did. I applied for my green card. And yes. And I had done one where I was in school because I wanted my husband to be able to use it to apply for residency.
Yeah.
We had a horrible lawyer that was based in Baltimore. Anyone listening to this, make sure you research your lawyers very well. And we trusted him. He's from West Africa, but he did, and we weren't the only victims, because I think that's what he does. He preys on medical practitioners, and then he uses that pain point, gets their money, but he doesn't do the work. Wow. And of course, you know, I had publications, I was cited, I was doing quite well, and everybody else I told about this NIW, they got it, but we didn't get it, because we had a very shitty lawyer, excuse my French. So research your lawyer very well. You can even do it yourself, you know. But anyways, my school filed, and they did the EB2, and we got it within a year. And I'm thankful because that has opened a lot of, you know, doors for us.
Yeah. And that's something I'll be talking about a lot in the next couple of weeks, is just moving from an F1 to a green card, because that's what I did. Like, at the time that I graduated, I was thinking about getting, you know, my green card, but I didn't have the money to get a lawyer at that time.
Yeah.
So I was forced to do it myself. And so I get excited when I tell people that they can actually file for their green cards themselves. They can go straight from F1 to green card. And people are like, what? I'm like, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
On the podcast, the next week, I'll be talking a lot about that. Hi. Wow, I've learned a whole lot about you. Like, I knew you could speak the language, you know, I knew you had a lot of Korean affiliations, but I didn't know you actually taught the language, and that's exciting. I know you're exceptionally, like, at a genius level. This has just upped that skill.
So much more. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It's not that difficult, though, once you've gotten past the basic stuff. And it helps me to, like, keep abreast of what I've known. Yeah. And I also cook Korean food, by the way. I love the cuisine. The food is really nice. If you haven't had them, just try it. Try the seafood pancake and try the bulgogi. You will love the rice, Nigerians. It's so... And I have kimchi fried rice, which is similar to our jollof rice. No, it's similar. It's not the same. I know we have the specialty with jollof rice. We don't even like the Ghanaians, like, talking about their jollof rice. Just try their food.
Yeah,
it's quite good.
Talk a little bit about your podcast. I know you have a podcast, and that's kind of how we met, because somebody connected us. We had a shared guest, and he
Mr.
told
Kenny.
Mr. Kenny. And he told me, and he's like, I'll connect you guys. And he did, and we struck it up. So tell me, I know it's the most simple podcast, but tell me, why did you start this podcast? At what point in your, in all of this going on, because it sounds a little crazy, you had all these challenges, and you still found time to, create a podcast. So when did you create your podcast, and why?
I created it in 2018, last year, and it was probably the worst time of the year to actually start podcasting, because I was stuck in my job and, smack dab in the middle of my job and just trying to navigate the tenure track system.
Mm.
But a lot of the conversations I was hearing about Nigerians and Africans as a whole in certain spaces weren't something to write home about. And I wanted to seize that narrative and change it. Because I told you about my Korean roommate.
Yeah.
And talking to her, I saw some similarities. Now, there are differences based on her culture, but I saw some similarities that, shared experiences. And I thought to myself, if I could scale that up, imagine everybody from those countries that were told, like, in a bad country, like a country like, Nigerians are this, Syrians are that. Mm-hmm. But you have people there. People are people, countries are countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I created my show, I called it More Sybil, because Sybil is like my pen name, and more because you get more of me. And I call it a podcast for Blacks and Asians and those who love them. So you have Blacks, which is like Nigerians, and anyone that identifies as Blacks, Asians. I mean, I do have a little bit of a connection with the Korean community, and in talking to a lot of my Asian friends, I do see those similarities. And those who love them, so some might say, well, I should say Blacks and Asians, but the third component, those who love them, which is like everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, interviewed a lot of people on the show from different countries and sharing their experiences, on grief, on acculturation, on immigration, on just, surviving sex trafficking, on navigating their career, like people sharing their stories, because I believe in sharing processes.
Mm.
I mean, there's some things you have to go through, like suffer personally, but some things you don't have to suffer through if you could just, know that somebody else is going through this.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my, in talking to my friends, be like, you should be out there more. You have these great ideas, but you don't like share them out, because public private, I'm still trying to get used to just being out there,
right.
Like within my circle of friends, I'm a different person,
right.
But being out there, because you never know how you're going to be received, and my skin is as tough as they come, but I can also I'm quite sensitive in some other areas. But after praying about it, and I had to overcome some personal challenges with my dad. You have to listen to the episode of my dad to understand that.
Yeah,
I realized that, it was time for me to be out there. And the responses have been so good. They've been very positive. I have, I've had people like tell me their stories too. One prime example, my friend, I was suffering from schizophrenia. She told me about it and she came on the show. I was able to raise money for her to get back on her medications. Right now I'm running a project because I just turned 33, to raise $300 to be able to fund scholarships back home in Nigeria.
Wow.
So I found ways to give back. I've reached that point. I haven't gotten there yet, like what you call there. But even along the way, I feel like there's some ways you can be a blessing to those around you. And so that's through my show and through the causes that I support on my show.
All right. So where can people find your podcast? Are you on Instagram?
Yes.
How can they find
you? Yes. I'm on Instagram as Mosibyl, MOSIBYL. So follow me if you like my content, fine. If you don't like, that's okay. You can find me on my website as well, www.mosibyl.com. I'm on Facebook under Mosibyl as well. And my podcast is called The More Sybil Podcast. And you can find it on, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, basically anywhere legally where you can get podcasts on. I'm on there.
All Thank you so much, Mo, for sharing with us. I've learned so much about you. I've learned, gotten some really great information. You've given people out there who are aspiring to go the same route that you took some great advice, you know, on how to get their visa, you know, how to survive in a new environment, even in a new school. I think these are really incredible tips that you've given on the podcast. And I'm excited to share this episode with the world. Thank you so much, Mo, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. And for those that might be in a spot right now, maybe for immigration or anything, mm-hmm. don't do anything desperate. Yeah. You know, talk to people, ask for information. And, you know, our baseline was just doing everything legal and doing everything godly, because we're not Christians. Mm-hmm. We believed in just, you know, doing the right thing. So don't get to that point of desperation where you, you know, break the law and even, you know, break your code with, you know, your religious code or whatever that would be.
Yes.
But always find people to talk to. I mean, if you're in a spot, you think some aspects of my story might relate to you, if you want to reach out to me, you can, you know, ask Ozzy to give you my email address. Mm-hmm. Freely I should give. You shouldn't live life alone. Find communities of people around you that are trustworthy, that can help you get out of whatever you're in. But, you know, it gets better is what I'm trying to say. And I've been through a lot, but it gets better.
Yeah. I actually recommend her podcast, you guys. Look it up, More Single Podcast. I've learned a lot. Like that episode you talked about, your friend who was going through that, I tried to go through it. I had to listen to it 3 times because I couldn't finish it. It was that heavy, but I knew that, that this story just needed to be out there. And so highly recommend your podcast to my podcast listeners. Check it out. Remember to rate on iTunes. Remember to rate this on Apple Podcasts if you love our content. Yeah. Let us know what you'd like to hear in the future.
Thank you.
If you think there are things that, you know, you really, really want us to talk about, but we're not really hitting those points for you, go ahead and let us know, and we'll be happy to do so. Thank you so much, Mo.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. And thanks a lot. Keep it up, Ozzy. You're doing a fantastic job. Like, you are encouraging. And I love what you're all about. You have a super fan in me. Oh. Don't just say that out there. Yeah.
Appreciate you, Mom.
All right, love.
Hey, listener. What do you think about this episode? Do you have a question or some feedback that you would like to provide, or a suggestion for a future guest? Now you can send me a voice message. Voice messages are an easy way for you to send me audio messages that just might end up on a future episode of the podcast. You can send me a voice message right now just by clicking on the link in my show notes. Can't wait to hear from you.